we get it underway this hour by welcoming in writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming. How is your Tuesday afternoon so far?
Oh, it's rubbish, Kimball. How about yours?
That's well, cool. It's better than rubbish. Yeah, it's a day. Have you eaten today?
No. Well, I had lozenge for the fishermen for like a cold. I had a couple of those. So you're probably not going to count that. So no.
I don't believe that would count. No, I'm going to say no. Eat something for God's sakes.
I will. I'm getting there, man.
All right. I hope so. You've been working hard lately. A lot of things going on. Today, well, actually, before we get to what we're going to talk about today, I just want a quick thought on the Stanley Cup Finals and Tampa Bay winning. Does this count because it was such a weird season? Do you give them credit for being Stanley Cup champs?
Oh, it extra counts to me. I think it's even more so than usual. Really admire what they did. I thought the winner of the Bruins-Tampa series was going to take the cup. And when the Bruins didn't get that game two and overtime, they were in trouble. I think the Lightning had something to motivate them after last year when they were upended in a kind of fluky way against a hot goalie. And if they stuck to their game this year, they were going to win. So, no, I thought it was impressive to make. People don't make a lot of sacrifices in this life. Like, they do, like, for the kids and things of that nature, but for their job, not to this degree. I mean, to be away from everything like that and just be amongst your friends, I think it's a testament to the friendship you have to have with your teammates. I think that was the added criteria this year, the added component, that you had to be good at being friends. And I like that. And I thought it was cool when they got the cup in the empty arena. And I think it's going to extra count. Baseball, with the whole two-month season and the fluky playoffs, maybe not count as much, but the Lightning, yeah, that'll go down. They earned that.
All right. Well, today we want to talk about secular works that have biblical sources, and I enjoyed exploring some of these when you let me know what we'd be talking about today. Let's start with a Spencer Williams film from 1941, The Blood of Jesus.
Yeah, it's a barn burner, right? It runs less than an hour, which will sound maybe strange to modern audiences, but there were actually quite a lot of films, and especially in the 1930s, but really not so much by 1941. But in the 30s, there were pictures that ran around 60 minutes long, and especially horror films could be like that, the Universal horror film. And just like there were race charts and race records, and there was Negro League, there was a whole sector of cinema called race films, and they were all black cast, and they were often made on the cheap, these films, and this is one of the sort of go-to examples. And they were, in some ways, they pioneered independent cinema. Now, Orson Welles did that too, and I think you can also make the same argument about these African-American artists. And so this film is a doozy. It has a lot crammed into these 57 minutes. It starts with a woman who is being christened at the river, right? And her husband isn't there. He claims that he's off hunting, but what he's really doing is he's like poaching on like his neighbor's property. And things quickly go amok. She goes home. He accidentally shoots her. You know how that is. You set your gun down and it goes off. Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to. My bad. And you have the crossroads. You have the devil. You have some like emissary for the devil. And I think what's really kind of surprising about this film too is the woman's dying and she's in limbo, right? And like she's going to go off like the ghost form and like have this job and like in a club. And it kind of bashes on to show how much devilment there is. Like there'll be jazz in this film, which is sort of strange, right? You wouldn't really expect that because jazz was an African-American art form. But, like, there's a jazz band on a flatbed truck in the scene, and they're at the crossroads a couple times, and there's the voice of Jesus, and it's all going to work out in the end. But there's really a lot happening.
From there we move to, man, an aptly titled poem by Lord Byron, Darkness, which I had never read before. Man, darkness doesn't begin to explain how dark this thing gets, and clearly human beings are terrible people.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought that this was like particularly apt for right now. So it's 1816, and the weather had changed in Europe because of these eruptions and these volcanoes and where it was in the Dutch East Indies. And so people didn't really know what was going on. And so naturally, some people tried to make a buck, predicting like, oh yeah, well, the world is coming to an end on this day. It was like sports betting, and this was handicapped and everything. So what Byron did was he used this as an opportunity to craft this poem about the apocalypse. He takes a lot of it from the Gospel of Matthew. He takes a lot from the Book of Revelation, and he takes some from Dante, but he goes pretty far. Later, Yeats is going to kind of do the same sort of thing with his whole "the center will not hold" and mere anarchy being loosed upon the world. That's what's happening here. It's kind of the poetic version of Goya's black paintings, like if you're familiar with those images. But people are just horrible in this poem. They turn on each other, and there is just this damning line about there being no love left. So, like, these two guys, the world has gone dark, and they're trying to create some light. Obviously, that's a metaphor. And they round up all these, like, religious artifacts, and they go to, like, the church, and they set them ablaze so they can get the light by doing this really unholy thing. And in that subsequent light, they see each other and recognize the one as a fiend. And so they turn on each other. It's kind of like the internet, isn't it? Like, I really feel like this is a poem that you could read in class now and be like, see, we have this internet thing, but that whole deal has been going on for a while. And it is terrifying, because I feel like Byron creates an image and then he gooses himself to come up with something more, like, horrible. I was reading it again when Carrie phoned, and I wasn't like, I was lost in the poem. I wasn't thinking about the phone ring. I jumped. I was like, Byron. So it is a doozy.
Yeah, and certainly it's a warning, stretching over 204 years, that, man, people, get your act together.
Right. It really is. I mean, it sounds strange to say this, but it's a very humanistic poem. And it's, I don't want to say it's like one of those kind of caught in Mather, fiery pulpit speeches, right, where you terrify people into decency, because it isn't like that. It has too much musicality for it to be like that. It's too sonorous. It's too imagistically rich. And it's obviously a guy tapping into what was happening at the time. He's using the news cycle to craft something, which not a lot of people can do, because you have to do it in a timely fashion, and you also, at the same time, have to make it timeless. And I really think that's kind of the standout component of this poem. That you could give this to your students, for instance, and have them write 800 words on how it's relevant to right now, and they wouldn't struggle with that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Let's move to a short story by Anton Chekhov that apparently he considered maybe his favorite work ever, The Student.
Yes, he was into this story quite a bit. And Chekhov was someone who understood, and I think probably like two or three people ever have really been able to do it at his level, that you can tell a lot of a story in the way that details stack, and that we can, and how characters perceive certain details. So he has this young, early 20s religious student, and he's tramping through the woods. He's going off to his destination, which is a device that Chekhov uses a lot. People run into each other in the woods at night in Chekhov stories with, like, strange regularity. I know, like, different time and everything. But he comes upon this mother and her daughter, and they're both widowed, and they're, like, at their fire. And he sits down to warm himself, and they start talking about the denial of Peter. So it's a story within a story. And the denial of Peter, for people who you'll recognize it when I say it, it's when, and Jesus, betting man himself, he's like, dude, I bet you, my buddy Peter, you'll deny me thrice before, like, the evening's out. And Peter's like, no, man, I love you. I'd never do that. Like, we're tight. And so you have these various instances of Peter. Someone's like, the Roman version of a cop is like, you know that guy Jesus? But Peter's like, nah, no, I don't know that guy. I don't want any problems here. And so you have the third denial with the as the cock crows, and it's like this wonderful device that's worked into it. It's a very dramatic device. But they're talking about this, and the student before that had been wondering, it's so cold, and there were other people years ago, 1600 years ago, whatever it was, that felt the same wind that I feel right now. And he's thinking about the grand sweep and the fluidity of history, and they have this conversation about this thing that occurred 1900 years ago, and one of the women starts to cry, and the guy goes on his way, and he's on this barge to the next part of his leg home, like it's quite a trip, and he's just kind of hanging over the railing, thinking about this, thinking how this is all bound together, but really what binds these three people is the sharing of a story. And yes, you have the biblical aspect, and it's a good story in the Bible. But to tell a story to someone is really to connect with them. And that becomes a huge plot device, the telling of a story in and of itself within this story.
And the story itself, if I'm doing my math correctly, takes place on Good Friday.
Yes, and Easter was an extremely important holiday to check off. And you know what, I think really that Easter, artistically speaking, I think Easter is, I don't know, it might be more important than Christmas, I feel like. I feel like Christmas is a time for ghost stories and whatnot. But Easter is the one that has the most symbolic potency because it's about hope, it's about rebirth, and rebirth can take so many forms. You don't have to be, you can be an atheist and believe in rebirth. What I mean by rebirth is getting off the mat, really, like in your life, not giving in to that which dogs you, ails you, otherwise would keep you down. And so Chekhov is using that as a kind of symbolic springboard, and he's having these, of course, it's three people sitting around a fire, the idea of the purification of the fire, the Holy Trinity, and yet they're lay people. Well, this is eventually not going to be a lay person, but you have these other two people who have borne these tragedies early in life, and then he goes off on a separate on his own, and yet somehow, even though he's continuing on with his journey, there's still that connection of that Trinity, of that idea of three people anchored in a place and time that is nonetheless transcended by their own journey.
Finally, we want to talk about a landmark concert 65 years ago at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, featuring Sam Cooke at 24 years old as the lead vocalist of the Soul Stirrers.
Yeah, actually writing about this today as I finish up this book on Sam Cooke's Live at the Harlem Square Club 1963 album for the 33 and the Third series. So they're 8 years apart. And so the record I'm writing about in this book is in front of this all-black audience, and people are going nuts for Sam Cooke. And you can draw an interesting parallel with what's happening nearly a decade prior at the Shrine concert, where he's with the gospel band, and Cooke was someone who, he leaves this band, and that was seen as a big risk, because think about this, if you were in the gospel band and you left, you couldn't come back. So there's kind of like an element of the film we were talking about, the whole like God versus Satan angle, but that's how you would have been seen. You had gone, not in Cooke's case, to jazz, but to soul music and rhythm and blues, you would have been tainted by the secular world. So it was actually a big deal when Cooke lit out on his own, but he had impetus to light out on his own because he was already kind of Black Elvis in 1955. He just was Black Elvis with this gospel context. And it's funny because later on when Cooke is interviewed about the music he made with the Soul Stirrers, he always refers to it as spiritual. He never calls it gospel music, which is interesting to me because spirituals are they're more outside, right? Don't you think of a spiritual as something outside, like what you would sing in a field? It's like a gospel song on a field trip. So there's a fervor to this live recording. And in the Soul Stirrers segment, it lasts about 20 minutes long. But if you didn't listen to the actual lyrics, you could call it some of the most perfervid, intense rock and soul ever waxed, right? I mean, it's people like crushing the stage, going nuts for this guy, like Beatlemania style. And it's a gospel concert by name, but like, when does rock and roll get more raucous really than this?
Well, and in the audience at the Shrine was the man who would lead Sam Cooke astray into the world of pop music, rock music, Robert Bumps Blackwell.
Yes, and he had a long association with Cooke, and he was just one of those people who was always around afterwards. Now, to give people the timeline, You Send Me doesn't come out. That's really like his first foot forward.
Right, in 57, that comes out, right?
Yeah, and so that's quite a bit different, right? Because what he was trying to do with that, he's trying to get into the homes of white suburbia. I mean, Sam Cooke was a master of, people think of him as this like creator of soul, but he really was so much more diversified. He was like Herman Melville. He was like Bob Dylan, like all of these different phases and demographics that you don't associate with Sam Cooke, and the fact that he's this amazing writer. He's this writer at the level of a Lennon and a McCartney and a Dylan, and you just tend to think of him, right? It's like, not you specifically, but people tend to think of him as this singer. And I wonder how much the fact that he's black has to do with that. The fact that when you see him on the stage, or picture nowadays, he's just holding the microphone. He doesn't have the guitar. But he, of course, he wrote the songs on the guitar. In fact, there's a demo of You Send Me where it's him playing a very bluesy guitar. But you go back to this 1955, and it's really, you can connect the dots between the Shrine and the Harlem Square Club in 1963, which was an album so intensely black that the label RCA Victor said, no, we can't put this out. This will just terrify America.
Can't wait to read your book about Sam Cooke as well. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Check him out at colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog as well. And please, please don't use acronyms. I applaud you for that stance.
You saw that.
Or emojis.
No, I'm nice. I'm nice. To each their own, right? I mean, just try to say what I'm interested in, man.
I appreciate it, especially when we're on the same team. I'm glad to have you on my side.
All right, I'll talk to you.
Thanks, Colin. Colin Fleming on Downtown.